Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast, Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Greetings, everybody. Welcome to another edition with your old pal, Rich Wilson. Before we get into it, I need to talk to you about our sponsors. This podcast is being supported by Save Our Souls Clothing. Those lovely boys, Mark and Stacey, doing wonderful things with their ethically sourced, vegan-friendly garms. And they help us keep the lights on. They're good lads doing good things. If you go to their website, sosclothing.co.uk/membrane, and use the promo code membrane, that's one word, you will get a 50% discount, not just from our merch of our tees and hoodies. You'll also get 50% off across their entire store. So go and do that. I mean, what's not to love, eh? What's not to love? We've also got some more merch coming out soon. Different colours coming your way. All that will be revealed later on. So go to sosclothing.co.uk/membrane. Use the promo code membrane, that's one word, and you'll get 50% off not just of our merch, but across the store. Thank you, Mark and Stacey, at Save Our Souls Clothing. Lovely lads. Also, we have Insane in the Membrane coffee beans. A roast made to our taste by Wogan Coffee in Bristol. So go to wogancoffee.com and use the exclusive membrane listener promo code membrane, again that's one word, and you'll get 10% off podcast packs. And can someone send me a picture, please? I want to see them. I'm going to buy some myself, but I want to see if you get them. Can you send us a picture? I want to see, and we'll stick it up on all the socials. We'll do all that. That'd be great. And that is the admin done. What else has been happening? I've been running around gigging. I'm all over the shop, to be honest, gigging far and wide. So I'll put all the dates up on my social media. I am Rich Wilson on the Instagram. I am Rich Wilson on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. So get hook up on there, and then I'll show you where my dates are. And if you'd love to come and see me, I'd love you to come and see me. I'd love to see you. So let's do that. So let's get on with it. Our guest this week is the brother of the wonderful comedian Mark Watson. Mark Watson, you would have seen on Taskmaster, various other shows. I've known Mark for years. Damn fine man, damn fine comedian. But his brother, I didn't realise his brother was doing some brilliant stuff. So I just wanted to talk to him. Heavily involved in football, and you know, he's coached, and he does a lot of things outside of football that football related, and being someone who doesn't really know much about football, I've wanted to get someone on to talk about that, and the fact that football is really, it's so ingrained in our society, you know, even if you're not into it. And I do say that in the episode, it's still there, it's still around, you know, it's still part of everything we do. So it was really interesting to talk to someone about that. So let's have Paul. And it was brilliant, it was so great. He's such a lovely guy, which you'll hear in the episode. So coming up in a minute, it's Paul Watson, and we'll also be putting this out on our YouTube channel. Click the link on the episode description.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A podcast from producer Paul.co.uk.
Insane in the membrane.
What an incredible life you've led. I mean, some people are into football, but wow.
You know what? Every time someone says to me, you've had a really interesting career, or it all looks like you've done lots of interesting things, I always just think, it weirdly doesn't feel like that to you when you're the person. Isn't that like, if you had to ask me what most of my life was, I'd say about 85% of it was like washing up. If I sort of like calculate 85, getting the bins out and stuff like that. But it's just, amongst all that, I guess there have been little moments that were interesting. But it is funny that when people say that to me, I think, not me, no, not really.
I think this is, because like you've just hit the nail on the head. Like I get people at gigs going, mate, you're smashing it, you're everywhere. And you go, I've spent a lot of time on the bus lately. There's a lot.
that thing of you being everywhere as well, I feel like it's something about social media or just the way we live our lives now that I feel like I'm always feel bored of myself and telling people what I'm doing. But I actually also find no one in the grand scheme, no one has a clue who I am or what I'm doing. So it's this weird mix where you're just yelling at the same few people. You're yelling at them daily. Look at all this stuff I'm doing. But in reality, you get out of that. I remember I did a project involving 2018. I organised a alternative World Cup for countries that aren't recognised, places like Tibet.
Yes.
And I spent, I guess, months telling every person I could think of, messaging media people, emailing, tweeting, just trying to generate interest in this tournament. And I had some success. It felt like I actually got some traction. And as soon as it finished, people started saying to me, God, if only I'd known that was on. That's what more could I literally could, I was pretty much walking around with a sandwich board saying alternative World Cup. I was like, I could not have done more. And yet, while it felt like to me I was boring everyone that I knew with it, in reality, you don't break out of that very small bubble unless you've got like hundreds of thousands of followers on the social media, which I don't. So,
no.
Yeah.
It's so true. The amount of times that people say, I either get invited out for dinner at weekends they say, where are you gigging? Are you gigging anywhere at the minute? And you're like, I don't understand. Like you've just said, all I do is tell people what I'm doing, where I'm going to be. And now you're like, oh, are you free Saturday? And you're like, I've just been... It's a privileged place to be. I'm not knocking it.
No. I don't tend to, it doesn't really bother me. It's just, it's a real sign of our times that, everyone's just shouting and shouting and shouting. We don't actually necessarily know if anyone's listening the whole time. It's just that like sort of sums up the social media world, isn't it? You're just like, I couldn't do more to tell people what I'm doing. And yet, obviously, that number of people is very limited. So I remember my social media policy always used to be, I don't want to bug people. So I used to basically only tweet when I felt I had something to say. And I remember telling someone about this and she just laughed uproariously. And she was like, yeah, you don't do Twitter much, do you? You don't understand the nature of it. And now I sort of do just wang on like everyone else on there now. But it does feel like that's the world we've created, where you have to be always saying something, even if you don't think you necessarily got anything to say. Otherwise, you're never going to get heard.
This is it. Like they're always saying, oh yeah, you need to upload these pictures all the time. You need to be doing this, doing that. And it's like, feed the beast. You have to feed the beast. Otherwise, the algorithms sort of push you out the way. They go, no, not you. You're not in this now. And you're like, so yeah. So then again, your audience becomes even more limited because you're getting punted out of the room by the algorithms. And it's
really dangerous. I mean, it's a horribly addictive thing. And like with everything else, social media, I resisted it for as long as I could. Realized it basically was just limiting your career options. You know, you do really have to be visible on these things if you're in a lot of fields, anything creative, anything where you might need to get numbers of people to do something. And so I had to embrace it. And as soon as I did, I did enjoy aspects of it. And you create this little bubble of people who are maybe more, in some ways, maybe more aligned and feel like friends than your actual friendship groups that you meet or people you meet in real life. But the downside of it is this thing that almost sums up human existence of like, I just want to get 5,000 followers. And then you get, and when you've even got 5,002, you're like, oh, that's an ugly looking number. I better get up to 6,000. And then it's like, well, I want 10. And I've not got to 10 yet, but I know if I do get to 10, my next thought will be, well, I better round this off to 12 and 15. But what does any of it actually mean? And I think you see that when you see people with 200,000, see people with 1.8 million followers, and you're like,
yeah.
At that point, you're surely just a victim to your own success. You know, I don't know, you can't actually see anything anyone's saying to you because you just get so much coming back at you every day. I don't know. I just feel like it's so addictive, isn't it? That thing of like...
It is.
Oh, 25 likes. I'm really smashing it today. And it's like, what does that actually mean? Especially if like four of them are people who live in your house. It's like, what's that mean?
Someone said to me that, I said that. They said, oh yeah, your post is doing really well today. And it was on like, I don't know, 30 likes or something like that. And I went, but it's only 30 likes. I went, no, you have no idea that actually most people only get one or two at best. It's like, but this doesn't make any sense. What are we doing?
I do think that, and I sometimes think that what I've ended up doing on Twitter a lot of the time is just saying the things I would have said to the person I'm next to on this platform so that like 12 people will go, yeah, that's quite funny, click a button. Whereas in the past, I would have said it to someone in the room who would have gone, yeah, that's quite funny. And it's like, what has changed now to, I don't know, I don't know whether that's, I don't know what it is, but it doesn't leave you feeling particularly great about your daily output when your biggest sort of fist pump is like, oh, 15 likes or something.
And you feel like such a failure if you're not a part of it, but at the same time it eats you up that you feel you have to be part of it. It's a really strange combination, and I really do think, and it's been said a lot on here, that it really is affecting people's mental health.
I can't see how it can be good. I really can't. But I also can't see now that not engaging with it is an option. I mean, it is, but I feel like limiting your world that way feels like you're intentionally handicapping your chances of progressing your career. And for me, if I'm not on it and I go on it, I'll see people succeeding and think, oh, you know, I should be doing that. So I don't think it's particularly healthy, but I also just, I don't really see a way of getting the genie back in the bottle with it. It exists and millions of people are on it. It's tough, isn't it? I tried basically ignoring it. I reckon I posted on average once a month and I had, you know, barely any followers at all. And then basically the more I tweet, the more followers I get. And that's not to do with the quality at all. And I've even got that thing that I've got like an old band or something where occasionally I'll post something and be like, oh, that's a great tweet, that's brilliant, and it'll get four likes, I think. And then occasionally one of them gets like a few thousand and I'll always hate it by definition. I'll say, god, what a stupid tweet, that was just some mindless crap about the football. And then it gets thousands of likes and I sit there thinking, why didn't any of you like that bit of gold dust 6 weeks ago? You immediately hate the tweet that succeeds just for succeeding.
It wasn't the one you wanted to. This isn't showing me in my best. Like, this isn't my gold. This is just some bullshit I pumped out. Yeah.
Also, I suppose because of the nature of my work, so a lot of what I'm doing is I'm often trying to raise money for football-related causes that are often quite worthy, and it's. I see so much of this. They're very worthy causes. I believe passionately in them. And so my tweeting is like, you know, look at this amazing thing, football inspiring people who have nothing. And it gets like 3 likes and no one donates. Mm. And then my next tweet is, you know, oh, look at this manager. He looks a bit like a pie. And then it's like 12,000 likes. And so the resentment comes from the fact that the thing you want the people to engage with is
yeah.
But that is the nature of the, that's the nature of Twitter. People don't really want to go on there and be told heart-rending facts about, you know, an island suffering from climate change using football to
no.
keep its national identity alive. They kind of want to go on there and go, oh, that's funny. And that's the problem with my work, is that basically there's a complete parallel between how successful a tweet is and how much I care about it. And they're completely inversely proportional.
I feel the same with football, because I wasn't brought up with football. All of my friends were into football, but my dad, it wasn't around me. So I grew up with music. And so I always felt, I went to see Arsenal a lot of time. All my friends were Arsenal fans when I was a teenager. So we go to Highbury all the time. Yeah. That's when you could just turn up on a Wednesday for 4 quid.
Those were the days, right?
Those were the days. You know, and I've been to, you know, my son, my mum's side of the family, they're all avid Chelsea fans. My best mate since I was a child, he's a Chelsea fan. So I've been to see Chelsea a lot. Chelsea have been in my life. Crystal Palace, I suppose, would be my team as I'm from there. Hmm. But I always felt like I just wasn't, because I wasn't into it as much, I just felt I wasn't part of anything. It's a really weird feeling.
That's really interesting, because I always wonder what my life would have been like if I hadn't been into football. And actually, I had a very brief spell where I did pick myself out of it. Like I went cold turkey for a really short time. And the jury's still really out on whether it was a good or a bad thing. I did genuinely open up my life to other things. I was like, suddenly Saturday at 3 p.m. my mood wasn't entirely dictated by 22 men I'll never meet, you know. Suddenly I had this other world. But on the whole, I guess it's really hard to unpick that, isn't it, to say, you know, but yeah, I probably feel the same about some topics as you feel about football, where you're kind of, you can get into them a bit, but you're never, I suppose I'm a bit like that with music. I was very passionate about music growing up, but now I'm sort of, I can hear music and enjoy it, but I don't have any sort of, I wouldn't have any knowledge in it, and I wouldn't be the person who tells you what's good. I suppose I'd feel like that if I was surrounded with people talking about it in a really passionate way, in the way that people do about football. I'd kind of think, well, yeah, but why are you so angry about that? Or why are you so happy about that?
But that's it. That's where I'm at with football. When I see, like friends of mine that their team loses, and it just ruins the rest of their day. Mm. Like, they're just so crestfallen, and I'm like, it shouldn't be that. Why are you so? Why is it? What is it about football that makes people feel that way?
You know, I can't really answer that, because if I could, I'd be sort of clever or one of those people who picks apart subjects successfully. I reckon it is to do with identity. I think it's to do with, this is a thing that I always found really amusing, especially since I actually got into football and was involved in teams. I always find it really amusing when people congratulate a fan of a football team when their team wins, as if they've personally done something to achieve that, if you see what it's like. It's as if like you're a massive fan of, like, I don't know, a TV show, and the main character manages to finally, you know, achieve happiness and escape prison or something. And someone comes up to you, pats you on the back, and goes, great effort, mate. Brilliant that you achieved that. But I sort of do get it, because it's about a sort of identity. It's about a factionalism of, like, I am, you know, for me, I am Bristol City. So if Bristol City win, I have achieved victory. And therefore, you know, if Bristol Rovers lose, this is in some way a boost for my self-esteem. And actually, I have sort of managed to step away from that a bit. But that was through becoming actually involved with football teams, where you actually are involved. It suddenly seemed a bit ridiculous to me to be, in a way, to be like celebrating my own victory in a team I wasn't involved in. But it's quite unique in that way, isn't it?
It is. We've lots of things, but there seems to be such a large element of the fans that are, that whenever, like, for instance, the other day I was coming back from somewhere on a train, and it was all complete. It was football fans as far as you could see, I think it was Manchester, Liverpool. And yeah, and it was, and they were horrible. It was really uncomfortable to be around. And I really, that's what I hate about football, is that that element of it, which I know isn't everybody, but it's a large majority.
No, and it's a weird sense of shame when you're part of that. So I remember growing up, and a Bristol City fan, we'd go a lot, you know, most weeks really, and became a season ticket holder at certain points. But amongst that Bristol City support, of which, you know, a lot of them are obviously lovely, normal, nice people, like you'd expect, there were also some twats, you know, fair enough, twats. And some of the songs you'd hear and what they were directed to. And I remember being relatively young and being in the wedlock. What stand was I in? I can't even remember which stand I was in, but I was at a City game when I was really quite young, and hearing City fans who you're identifying with, you know, they're my group, singing songs directed against Ian Holloway, the Bristol Rovers manager, making fun of his daughter's disability. And I remember hearing these songs and thinking that's not something I want to be part of.
No.
And this weird, you know, similarly when you'd hear anything sort of racist, or it wasn't very, I don't think it was very common to hear racial abuse, but it's a similar thing if you're in a group of people and suddenly, even if it's not all of them, some of those people start to behave in a way that's really abhorrent to you, but you are part of that in-group, and it's a really awful feeling. And I always remember feeling that. I mean, I feel it with England fans as well, you know, this thing of England fans are laying waste to like large cities in Europe and in the name of English football. And so I really struggled to support England at all, because for me, it's something about being added to this group, you know, this idea that those people are going to win. And you feel so much like you're not part of that. It's being done in, it's this thing of it being done in your name in some way, you know. I'm a Bristol City fan. Yeah. Bristol City fans are chanting this, therefore the Bristol City fans are chanting it. You are one of them. It's a real difficult thing, that. And I look at football in that way. I look at football fans and think, I find it a very hard atmosphere to be in a lot of the time these days.
That's what has put me off over the years, is that, like, when you saw the videos of people, all the England fans breaking into Wembley, like, you know, piling through, like, you saw the videos of them before, like, just like you said, just laying waste to Leicester Square or wherever they were, and you're like, why does it have to be that? Because it doesn't happen with rugby, or cricket or any other sport. There's just something about football that attracts those kinds of people, and it's a real shame. It's a real shame, because it's not everybody. There are people that, you know, love the game, and they love going to see it. And
that is one of the weird things, isn't it? Is like, I suppose it's the same with all, anytime you try and label any, you know, big group of people that are, you know, you take a huge group of people and you try and label them in one category. I mean, that is effectively stereotyping.
Yes.
But, you know, it's always a bit like that, isn't it? You can't say rugby fans are like this, football fans are like this, really, in a way, because, you know, there are also awful rugby fans. Like, I've definitely been on trains of drunk rugby fans, and they're awful in a whole different way. Yeah. It's a sort of different type of awfulness, but it is nonetheless pretty dreadful. And, you know, that's the same with football fans. We get a lot of this saying football fans are one way. And in my life, I've had a lot of people look at me differently for saying football is what I'm involved in. It still happens. People will say, well, what do you do? And I'll say, well, football, and they won't listen to the next section, you know, which is football for development, football, you know, helping, trying to help people through football. And people just think, oh, he's a hooligan, then he's a thug. Or more than that, they really think you're just not very clever. And that stereotype really is still there, that if you're into football, you're just not a very clever person.
Yeah.
And I find that amazing, to think that you can just say, this sport that billions of people around the world enjoy, for liking that, you must therefore be of a certain sort of intelligence or have views. It's like, you wouldn't do that with most things, would you? Like, you know,
that's true, actually. Yeah, you wouldn't do that of anything else, to be honest. So, yeah, I do know what you mean. And it's funny seeing it when you see like what Marcus Rashford has been doing and the work that you do, when that's the thing, they don't, that sort of stuff kind of gets, I don't know if it gets pushed out of the way or
with
other people, they kind of focus on the troubled side of football rather than the beneficial stuff, like you do.
Well, I wouldn't put me and Marcus Rashford in the same sentence in our sort of off the field any more than I would for our on the field abilities. But he's in a world of his own. But I see what you mean. I think there's always this thing that happens with people like Marcus Rashford where there's this concentrate on the game thing that gets thrown around. You know, this kind of you should be focusing on your football. And what it is, I think, is a way of silencing people, because I think there's a fear amongst those in power of the fact that football's such a powerful voice. It's such a powerful, footballers have such enormous reach and they generate such immense respect from people that it's relatively new, in my opinion, in English football for someone like Marcus Rashford to use that for social good and for challenging the system that's there. I think it's terrifying. It must be terrifying, especially because if you're a politician, you're a Tory politician, and you know you're quite happy with the status quo. You've suddenly got this guy who is a hero to so many people, but also a demographic that barely vote. Really, it's the demographic that vote the least, who suddenly is getting involved in political issues in the country in a really positive way that is very, very easy to understand, very easy to get behind. It's very hard to not support what Marcus Rashford stands for. So it must be terrifying. If you're a politician, you're thinking, this guy's immensely popular and respected. He's got a whole demographic of people who would not bother voting normally. And his politics stand against our interests. So I think there's this thing of like trying to silence and discredit, because it must be really scary. And I think it's brilliant. It's been a real switch from footballers being people that just don't engage in that side of the world, so suddenly the England team have become this, on the whole, this really positive force. And like, I've never had an England team in my lifetime that I've actually really liked as people. You know, I've been able to support them, but it's very, you know, it's an amazing switch that's happened in a very relatively short period of time. And this idea of sports people becoming activists is, I think, just a fantastic thing, really.
Yeah, well, this is exactly what needs to happen. The talk of about, you know, people taking care of their mental health, and the fact that most people at some point will struggle with their mental health, and you need people like that. So it's good that, you know, Ricky Hatton's coming out and saying stuff about his depression, and Peter Crouch as well, and this is such a great thing to see, because those people that go and smash Wembley up are the very people that we want to go and get into and say, look, let's have a chat. Let's sort this. Let's find out what's going on. You know, why do you want to smash Wembley up? Just let's figure this out.
Because that's not, you're not doing that for just, it's not just for like, you know, for fun. It's, I agree. I think growing up, this stuff, it just wasn't talked about. Mental health wasn't talked about. And in sport, it really wasn't talked about from my experience, in that, you know, I've been in dressing rooms, not at a good level, but I've been in dressing rooms for football teams. It's just, you just wouldn't talk about that. It was taboo. And I think the fact it's not taboo as much as it was, and that, you know, we have prominent people talking about it, it just can only be a good thing. There's no downside to that. But, you know, I also think that I certainly fall into this trap of thinking, because the people around in the bubbles we create, because these voices are so respected and lauded, and because things seem so much healthier, I have this inability to realise that the world's a lot bigger, and in a lot of the world, things haven't changed enormously. And that's always a bit of a jolt. I always find that around election time. That's the biggest example, isn't it? You know, you're online and you think, wow, massive Labour majority on its way, and then you switch on the actual news and you think, right. You know, and I basically see same with Brexit, same with everything, where what you see online is a curated version of the world, and it's so much often what you'd like to see, and then you step into the reality. And I think it's similar with sport. You know, things have come a long, long way and they're getting better, but there's still probably a lot of the country where it's a massive stigma to mention mental health issues, and it would sort of not be welcome in the dressing room. I'm sure that's still true a lot of places.
Yeah. Well, and even the subject of sexuality, you know, there still remains. I mean, because statistically, there must be some players who are gay. yet they don't feel that they can come out and, you know, announce that and be themselves if there's still a feeling that they have to hide that because it wouldn't be accepted.
Yeah, and it's I think football is a long way away from being where it needs to be on that front as well. But as I say, you know, it's funny because I fluctuate between thinking progress is always good, and you know, things are very much different from when I was, you know, 15, 16, and in those environments, things have definitely improved. But there's still such a huge way to go, and it's like you fluctuate between the positive and the negative on it, you know. But I do think the pace of change is increasing, because I think for years nothing seemed particularly to change. I'd feel over the last 2 or 3 years, as I say, I think probably things like having an England team that are willing to stand up to injustices, you know, that is massive. That you can't really overstate that, especially when you've got tabloids that are basically hate-filled tabloids that suddenly realise these people are the heroes. We have to publicise their message. So you've got, you are challenging, the tabloids in a way that politicians can't, because politicians are just politicians. Whoever, you know, I don't really get massively into party politics, but whatever Keir Starmer says, he's Keir Starmer, head of Labour, he's always going to be looked at as a politician. He's trying to get into power, and he'll say what he has to say to get in, and he's, you know, whereas a footballer can speak without any of that baggage attached, and I think they're much more relatable people as a result.
Absolutely. I think that whole thing with taking the knee, it really brought out the worst in a lot of people watching the game. You know, like, why are you bringing politics into this? Why are you doing that? But the next minute, they're screaming racist abuse at those players. And you're like, that's why this is happening.
I've seen a lot of that kind of stuff in my time. I remember I lived in Verona for a while. And Verona, everyone thinks of Verona and you think of the Romeo and Juliet and it's a beautiful place and amazing culture. But actually, in terms of football, you get to see exactly how right-wing and how much racism, racism has dictated a lot of what Hellas Verona, the main club, that club is just notorious for it. And they had a situation where the ultras, the main fans, basically said, we won't accept black players. We can't have. And this was relatively recent, relatively recent. But sure enough, if a black player and eventually black players did play for Hellas, and also, you know, for Italy, you've had Mario Balotelli famously, you know, and you'd see the same people that would be throwing racist abuse would be the people celebrating when those players scored. And you see it in the England too. And it's very hard to understand how that's possible. But in a way, again, it shows up the extent of the problem, isn't it? Racism is, there's so much of that in the way the government frames its talk on racism, isn't it? It's, you know, there's good immigrants, there's immigrants that have, you know, done something great, so therefore we've got to treat them like human beings, whereas there's also immigrants that are just here to steal our jobs and take our money and all that, and they're other. And it's I think it's the same in football, really, isn't it? It's, you know, people can maintain their racist views because there are helpful black players, and then there are the scary black players who we don't want, and it's all just football's just a microcosm of our society. It just shows us what our society is like. Yeah. It holds a mirror up, and racism is a problem in everything, isn't it? Really,
it is. Yeah, and I stupidly years ago thought, racism seems to have died down a bit. But you forget that it's just everywhere, and I hadn't. Yeah, because it doesn't affect me in that respect. So I kind of went, everything seems to be fine, because I wasn't hearing it.
Yeah,
and then suddenly, in the last few years, now it's again, it's everywhere, and I'm here. Maybe I'm just more tuned into it now, but
I don't know. Social media is again a massive way that a white person who is not affected directly, you know, I can't be a victim of racial prejudice. I'm white. I'm middle class. I'm British. I basically won't experience racism, but social media gives the opportunity to see it, physically see it going on. And it really, I guess in that way, at least it's helpful, only in so much as it shows the extent of the problem to people like me and probably like you we don't have to think about it on a daily basis. That's not to say it's not there every single day, and in many, many, like, obviously blatant ways all the way through to very subtle ways. In football, yeah. for example, the lack of black and, you know, black coaches in the game, it's almost negligible, yeah, right. the number of black coaches in football. And that's the type of racism that doesn't, if you're white, you don't think about that. It doesn't rub your nose on that every day. It does if you're young and you're black and you look at coaches, you think, well, that's not something that black people do then, is it? You know, you don't have examples to say that's a normal path. So obviously for black people, it's there every day.
Yeah.
But these like systemic elements of systemic racism, you don't think about if you're white until someone alerts you to them, I think.
Yeah.
That was certainly my case anyway.
Same. And it was always, if you heard, you know, somebody, it would have to take someone to be like verbally racist in front of you, and you go, hey, pack that in, mate.
Yeah, you see, but that's it. That's racism. You know, I mean, you don't necessarily think, I've watched 35 manager press conferences, every one of those managers is white. You don't necessarily think there's an alarm going off there. But, you know, being involved in football and seeing how impossible it is for black coaches to get a break, and you know, and similarly Asian coaches, and you know, I know a brilliant British Asian coach who, if his name was John Smith, he'd be working in a league club, at least, you know, maybe League One, League Two. Wow. And he can't get near a job, I have no doubt at all it's because of his name, and
really
people look at his name and they think, I don't know if they even think it consciously or if it's a subconscious bias, you can't even know, but it's everywhere you look in that way. And all you really get is lip service from the FA and from the powers that be. You don't really get anyone burrowing into what the root of this is.
Yeah. But when you went, because like you said, so you were outside, so you're in Verona, and you also went to, where else did you go? Because you went to...
Started off in Micronesia.
That's it. Yes,
tiny, tiny islands in the Pacific. That was just like it's sort of an idiotic quest with me and my mate to still play international football, despite the fact we were 25 and we were, you know, very average, would be being polite. So that's sort of the first job I did in my proper career. And went to this. Well, basically decided we'd find the world's weakest international football team and we'd play for them. And so found this island, tiny little island called Pompeii in the middle of the Pacific, that on its Wikipedia page said they were the only team never to have won a game in any kind. And they'd just lost 16-1 to Guam.
Wow.
And we sort of jokingly at the start thought, what if we message them and see if we can qualify to play for them? And then gradually it became more and more real, because the head of their FA had just moved to London by complete fluke, and said, look, there's no team, you know, they gave up, but if you want to go out and coach, you know, that would be great, they'd love you. And sort of it changed from being international manager to international coach, which was more logical, because to get citizenship, it turns out it's one of the hardest places in the world to get. We'd had to renounce British citizenship, learn the language and marry a local woman. And I negotiated two of those with my wife, but the third one was
at the time. No go.
There was not a lot of movement on the third one. it was sort of a stupid idea. And then getting there and sort of experiencing actually that, you know, football had just not been an option for these kids, and you know, that it was a really neglected place in terms of sports funding, and actually became a proper project. You know, spent almost 2 years out there building football program from scratch, more or less, you know, with all the way from schools programs through to a sort of de facto national team to try and win their first game. And that was sort of the idiotic thing that led to an actual proper introduction into sort of the way football can affect people and be a thing for sort of national identity and pride. And, you know, we were in this island where people just thought, football wise, sports wise, people just had given up on the idea of success. They just thought we don't win. And it was a whole process of trying to convince them they could win, and then trying to make them win, because otherwise all you've done is just say to them, it's like building them up for this horrible defeat. So yeah, no, we it was sort of a long process, but that was how it started, really.
Yeah. And were you successful? Did you get them? Did they win?
Yeah, we did win a game actually, and the funniest thing about that is it was only against a sort of second division team from Guam, but it meant everything to us. And the funniest thing is we were 6-1 up. So obviously for our players it was like the biggest game of their lives. The other team, it was a pre-season friendly for this slightly overweight. I mean, they looked a bit like a pub team in this country, and they had no idea what they're coming out to. You know, this team bellowing our national anthem, like bashing on the dressing room doors, like coming out as if it was a war. And we went 6-1 up with about 7 minutes left. And I'm there posting the touch lines.
Wow.
Absolute nervous wreck, just yelling, screaming. Because I think my brain was saying, if we lose now, that's it. Might as well just end football forever. Imagine that. Never won a game. We were 6-1 up with like minutes left. We drew 6-6. That would just be it. But no, we did. We won 7-1, luckily. But
excellent.
There was a moment where they scored, and because we were 6-0 up, they scored 6-1. And our goalkeeper, who was just this real chilled out guy, just put his thumbs up and went, "Good shot, man." And the rest of his teammates just turned on him and were like, "What? Shut up."
So encouraging. That's what you need.
I know,
that's
right? What you need. But that's just what I was. But I on the side, I was thinking exactly the same. I was like, dude, you've not grown up as a Bristol City fan, have you? You do not ever expect your team not to screw up.
What was it about Bristol City? Because there's Bristol City and Bristol Rovers.
Yeah. Yeah.
What makes someone choose their team? I mean, because if I was into football, I'm assuming my team would be Palace, because that's where I was born. I grew up around there. So that's what I'm thinking. But you've got two teams in the same city. So
yeah, it's you don't choose is the simple answer, really, in that you're told by your older sibling or your dad. My dad's actually a Bournemouth fan. He's from Bournemouth. So we actually spent a lot of our childhood laughing at how bad Bournemouth were, and then suddenly they completely surpassed us and became Premier League team. So I guess that was karma. But yeah, I was told basically by my brother, although when we were both very young, actually, and this is something I won't admit to many people, we sort of supported Rovers too. Not actively, but we wanted them to do well. And it was only as you get a bit older and you go to games as a bit of an older, you know, as a teenager or whatever, you start to develop the dislike. Although the dislike for Rovers isn't very strong in me, and I'll probably be hated even more by Rovers fans, but it's actually just because it's not very interesting. They're so much below us. You kind of, I grew up seeing those derby days, and there'd be huge days, you know, you'd have the nerves building up to it, the hatred, the nerves, and all that's really been gone because we haven't been in the same division as them for so long. I'm anti them at the moment because they got Joey Barton as their manager, and I'm sort of anti everything Joey Barton does. But actually, I don't have any dislike for them. I'd love them to be back in our division. I think it'd just be fun, you know.
But it's funny that even like I say, growing up, not really being into football, I was always more into music, going to see bands. Football is still always there. It's always on in the background, even if you're not into it. It's so ingrained in everything we do that it's absolutely brilliant that now, you know, footballers are being seen as, you know, people to aspire to be, you know, because they're doing good things on and off the pitch, you know.
Yeah, and I think we had a relationship where, and I this is where you can get quite conspiracy theory-ish, but I think we had a relationship with our footballers where the media made them into absolute villains a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the time they were just normal young men who have become very wealthy suddenly and very, you know, loved by everyone. So that's going to mess you up. If you're a 17, 18-year-old kid who often hasn't come from a particularly wealthy background, usually, you know, quite a lot of the time most footballers don't come from wealthy backgrounds. That's just the demographic. It's the way it is.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're a multimillionaire. Everyone loves you. Everyone wants a piece of you. That's going to mess up most people. But I do think the media played a huge role in vilifying these players.
And absolutely.
I don't know if that's just because dumping on people sells, which it undoubtedly does. But looking at it, I'm almost getting into conspiracy theory of, you know, is the media is affected by the elites, by the wealth, you know, the media is dictated by the parties in power. Maybe it was an intentional thing to keep these people down because they are potentially powerful voices. But if you're reading about, you know, we just grew up reading about Wayne Rooney's sex scandals. But now suddenly we've got a group of players who have this power and are using it positively, yeah, it can't be a very comfortable place for the people who are supposed to be running the country properly, you know, to suddenly have like Marcus Rashford tie them in knots like that and have a bigger platform to tell his story how he wants to do it, you know. That's the other thing. When we were, you know, 10 years ago, there wasn't a way for footballers to engage with the public except through the press, and so your messaging would be dictated by the press. They could destroy you, they could choose your quotes as they wanted to choose them. You didn't have your own relationship with fans, and it's so different now that through social media a footballer can go on there and put out exactly, you know, I'm sure it comes through their people, I'm sure there are checks and measures on it, I'm sure there are sponsors who have an impact on what they're allowed to say, but footballers can essentially tell us their stories, and the press can't control them. And that definitely is a shift in dynamic, because if you've got to give an interview to the Sun, you know, if you're telling the Sun something, not that in my opinion anyone should tell the Sun anything, but if you're giving an interview to the Sun is going to pick out the quotes they want, they're going to make the headline. You don't have any way of really saying what you want. But now you can just put it on your social media, it'll get more views than anything, and no one can really tell you what to do.
It's true. It's very true. And that it was shown as well when, you know, Rashford was trying to, you know, sort out the meals for deprived children, and then he showed the MPs voting against it, and you're going, what are you doing? It doesn't affect you anyway to feed the children, yet there you are voting against it. It's insane that this government they are less popular than the footballers now. They just are.
I mean, this government personally is pantomime villain levels. You know, it's genuinely like, so is the policy is basically like, do you think we can boot some cats into the Thames? Do you think we'll get away with it? Yeah, let's do it. We'll shut everyone up if they come later. You know, they are at that level of villainy where you're like, how does anyone think that's... But you know, what remains to be seen is whether this kind of power that someone like Marcus Rashford has, whether it can be utilised, because the problem we have, I guess, as ever, is the only power we have over politicians is voting them out. And the problem slightly is, if you're someone like Marcus Rashford, you're not going to stand as a politician. You're not voting for Marcus Rashford. So he has to tie himself to, when the time comes, if he wants to do this, he has to tie himself to a political party. And I just don't know that that's something he would want to do, because that always comes with difficulties. You know, he for the same reason some of us might not particularly like Labour, but yeah, we'll vote for them over the Tories. That might be how he feels, but that doesn't mean he's going to put his name to Labour. That's a very different process. And if he doesn't do that, how is he then going to influence the power that he has, getting people to vote? And that's the thing. I don't see him going out there and going vote Labour, because that isn't really fair of a... It may not be what he feels, and it's also just not a fair thing to expect of him. But on the other hand, if you're a disaffected young person, you would vote for Marcus Rashford, but you wouldn't vote for Labour necessarily.
That's
the difficulty. It's that disconnect. The Tories are fine being unpopular as long as they're popular with enough people to get voted back in.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. How do you change the subject a little bit? Going back to you, how do you feel now that, you know, because you don't play football anymore, how did it feel when you got to that point that you're like, oh, this is it now? It's not going to go any further. That must have been, you know, it's something you really wanted to do. It was your dream. And then you just get to a point, you go, that's not going to happen. This must be quite hard to take.
It's weird. It's weird. I mean, I wasn't close enough for it to be heartbreaking. Like, I really... Right. I was never good enough, which I think made it a lot easier. The kids I really sympathise with, and I see a lot of this, are the kids who give their whole life to this sport.
Yeah.
And sometimes I saw a story that was being touted as a real positive thing. You might have seen it, where it was Arsenal have just signed the new Messi. You know, he's 4 years old. And this genuinely happened.
Yes.
They didn't genuinely sign him, because... that's nonsense. You actually can't sign him. He's just playing for Arsenal Academy, sort of unaffiliated. But I remember thinking just how sad it is, because I've come across a lot of this in the game, and it's kids who at a very young age are are, you know, they love football, I'm sure, but their parents are pushing and pushing and pushing, and football is everything. And they have no doubt in their mind that they're going to be professional footballers. Yeah. And partly our culture taps into this. It says, believe in yourself and you'll succeed, which sounds like a very positive message. But you see so much of this, you know, no one believed, but this guy stuck to it and overcame. And all this is, and these messages are reinforced again and again and again. And then sure enough, they get to sort of whatever it is, whether it's 16, whether it's 21, and they're not up to it, or they get injured, you know, one or the other, and clubs just cut them loose. They're just dumped by the side of the road. And what have they actually, you know, they've spent all their lives pushing this pathway, and it's gone. It's just snatched away. Sometimes it's snatched away in an instant, like with a foul, guy goes in the back of you, and that's it. That's your entire dream, your entire life. And there's nothing much to back you up, because to succeed at that level of football, you almost have to be single-minded. It's very hard to also pursue. You can pursue an education, but a lot of the time it's a secondary. You know, it's obviously secondary, because the dream is to be a footballer. And if you spent too long studying, you probably wouldn't be playing football. Like, that's how it's seen. It's not necessarily true, but that's the perception, isn't it? And so, yeah, those kids, they're the ones I feel heartbroken for, because their identity is, I'm a footballer. And suddenly you're not a footballer, and you're at such a young age, but you're having to reevaluate your entire relationship with the world. And there are millions of them, because the percentage of success is so tiny. And at least for me, I was never even close. So even though I managed to be immature enough to convince myself I might manage to make it, I had a backup, I had education, I had, you know, it wasn't the same. I was very lucky. I had good education. I had other plans and other things I loved and other things I could do. Even just that I could be a football journalist, you know, I was able to write well enough that I could make a career out of that. That's just not an option to most kids in that situation. So, it's a really brutal thing, that, to say to someone, this, your identity is no longer yours, you know, go find another one. And
And like you say, they've given their entire life to that dream. And then, and especially in those formative years as well. So, when they're teenagers and puberty's hitting, and you know they're having to deal with that, and at the same time someone says, "Yeah, this is as far as you go with this."
And at that age, yeah,
how do you recover?
To be honest, it's hard enough for the people who do make it in some regards. I mean, maybe if you make it and you're a Premier League player and you rack up a good amount of money and you look after it, and then you go into like fast track into coaching or whatever, punditry. For them, it's not a bad situation, but for a lot of players, it's you don't earn infinite money. You know, you earn a decent wage by most people's standards, but then at 35, you're finished. That's the end of you. So, and there just aren't infinite coaching jobs. You know, the maths bears that out. If you want to coach at a level, a professional level, there are only so many jobs to go around. And you think about the fact there are, you know, 30 players, including the bench, at every game you go to. They're not going to find employment within the sport. So it's a brutal thing. I think it's really tough.
I know there's people with comedy that, you know, I've gigged with these people so many times, and they've been going for years, same time as I've been going, and yet they're still doing the open mic nights and the smaller gigs, and I'm like, I admire your determination, but I don't know. This just isn't going to happen.
But do you think they want it to happen? You know? That's the interesting thing for it with comedy.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
I mean, is it... Because there's such a fine line, isn't there, between the, like, it's just really great that they get the entertainment, they want to go out and do it for themselves, but there's something really tragic about the thought of every night thinking, is this the night a commissioner from Channel 4 is in and loves me, and then my career launches, you know? And I think I was a bit like that with football for a while, despite myself thinking, oh, maybe, you know, just maybe this will be the day I suddenly, you know, score three brilliant goals. But I also kind of just never knew, even if I knew that wasn't possible, I would have just enjoyed playing football anyway. So it wasn't quite so tragic as that, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. But what you've done since, the work you've done since has been incredible. Like Kitmus is a fantastic thing that you did. Again, you don't realise that there are kids out there that they don't even get to play football. Like they don't even get to get a kit. I remember as a child wanting a Chelsea bag because everyone else had Chelsea bags. I wanted this for school, and we just couldn't afford it. You know, And it was heartbreaking,
though, right? It's got much worse as well. The prices of football shirts are just outrageous.
Yes,
it's a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. And so, yeah, I mean, Kitmas was born of for quite a long time. I guess about 10 years. I generally collect a lot of kit up and send it abroad to places where kids don't have stuff. You know, it's been something I've done for years. Usually football boots mostly, but also some football shirts, and send them off to projects that are doing good work with kids in different countries. And and it was only relatively recently, like last year, that this idea of Kitmas came about, because I had I got given some kits. It was really nice, brand new shirts, and they'd initially said, can you give them to refugee camps, to kids in refugee camps? And I had to point out very gently that it's not really appropriate, because you can't really give just 10 kids in a refugee camp a lovely brand new Man United shirt. That's not really how it works. And they were very understanding, said, well, look, we trust you, do what you want with them. And it occurred to me that, you know, in this country, you know, it was everywhere, you know, reading everywhere, and it's always been the case, but poverty was very much front and center, and the fact COVID had plunged so many families into this desperate position, and around Christmas as well, you know, it was really hitting hard. And just thought, you know, the best thing we could do with these shirts probably is to find a way to get them to some parents to give to kids, or you know, to community centres to give to kids who aren't going to get Christmas presents this year. And from that idea, and, you know, tweeting that out and seeing if anyone else wanted to join in, it just snowballed into this huge thing. We ended up giving away 1,000 football shirts to community centres, 16 community centres around Britain, who obviously work with families year round and could distribute them into the communities. And it was, in a way, a really lovely, heartwarming thing. And I love doing it, and I'm really excited we're doing it again this year. But as you say, it's a kind of sad eye opener into just how divided wealth wise this country is, how many families are struggling, and how many have just stupidly large amounts of wealth, and the disparity. And I think the football shirt market has made me so angry, because you see these football shirts and they're 60, 70, 80, 100 pounds for kids. And you're thinking, children have a pressure put on them. You know, everyone knows this. Peer pressure is there. Children will be going out with their friends and they'll be like, well, they want to have the new Liverpool kit. And they're going back to their families. And that kind of cost, you feed a family on the amount of money that this football shirt is costing. It's unreasonable. And I understand economics, you know, I understand people are trying to make money and that the economy works that way. But it feels to me like it's a mark of how football has extracted it's lost track of where the fans are. It's lost track of where it was supposed to represent communities and make them feel empowered, make people feel like their identity meant something, make them feel a part of something. And what you're actually saying when you market a child's Liverpool shirt at £90 is it's not for you. That's what you're saying to them. You're saying, you can't afford this. This isn't for you. And if football clubs are happy with that, then so be it. But I just think that's a really depressing sentiment, I think.
Absolutely.
Whereas what we saw was that normal people rallied around and, you know, it was amazing. People clearing out their old football shirts and, you know, lovely, good new condition shirts, giving us those. But some people just donating so we could buy new shirts. And we didn't buy any of the 50 quid shirts. Obviously, we shopped around and we got shirts that were affordable so that we could give a good number of shirts away. But clubs didn't really want to support us, the big clubs, as you'd expect. But it's just, as I say, it shows the two worlds. You know, you have this amazing sense of unity and this lovely thing that comes through football where people really do rally around and they look after people. And then you have the big elites and these superpowers and these big businesses that are just sucking people dry, basically. They're just big business.
And it's so short-sighted to do that, because you think if you were to make the shirts affordable, more people would buy them. So you'd make money anyway. You'd make the money, and more people would be into football. There'd be more of a sense of, again, like you say, community. I don't know. I think it would just bring people more together, like you said, and like, because that's what football used to be. It used to be families taking their kids to the football.
Yeah.
you know, and sat around and you know, the amount of stories I'd heard of dads, that was how they kept their connection.
Yeah,
between
because men often, you know, yeah. Men can't talk about, famously, a lot of men can't talk about emotions and feeling. And football is a great way of transplanting that. You go watch the football together, and you're able to, you know, I could have cried in front of my dad watching football. I couldn't cry in front of my dad, you know, in any other scenario. It's men are able to, you know, and it's not just men, but, you know, it's definitely a really important avenue for that. And, you know, growing up, we couldn't always afford a new kit every year. You know, most people couldn't. They've always been expensive, football shirts. But the level of difference, and for going to football too, as a family, we could go to football. And okay, it was Bristol City, and we were at a bit of a low point in our career, in our football journey at that point. I think we were sort of in the bottom two divisions, in and out. But I remember going, and the first game I went to was Anglo-Italian Cup game against Oxford. And it was because you had to play English teams to qualify to play the Italian teams, and we never did. So you just end up watching us play Oxford or Portsmouth. And it was a quid, you know, it was a quid to get in for kids, and it was something like £3 or £4 for adults. And okay, obviously currency's changed, like this is 20 years ago, but not that much. It was a cheap afternoon out, whereas now you look at it and you're like, you could probably go away somewhere like Spain on a holiday cheaper than you could
take
your family to Arsenal for a game. It's not sustainable, in my opinion. And I think the business model's just gone. When you've got foreign powers, basically foreign nations, owning football clubs, running them as if they were yachts, just to have the status symbol of them, to make them look better, so that people will cheer the name of Saudi Arabia rather than thinking about what they're doing in Saudi Arabia. How can that game be compatible with this game that we grew up with, where it's you know, families going out and having a good day out, and the you know, identifying with the players? They weren't that different to us, but they were much better at football, but they were human beings. You know, and that's the thing, the super athletes that we've got now, you know, it's just all gone. It's all gone extreme, and it will only go more extreme, I think.
It will. But they are, that's it. They are just, you know, they're not, you know, the stories that you'd hear of, you know, footballers falling out of nightclubs and doing this, that and the other, you know, like, you know, the George Bests and whoever.
The number of players I saw growing up who were definitely hungover.
Yeah.
There were a lot of players that just looked either, but you know, they, and some of them, you know, their guts, they just look like normal human beings, a lot of these players. And yeah, I mean, it's all just become, same with everything, it goes to its extreme, doesn't it? Players are suddenly worth millions, they're assets, they can't be treated like normal people because they're worth millions and hundreds of millions. And it just feels a very detached game from, I mean, you still get non-league football, which is much more like what I associate with football. You know, the non-league game is still much more similar, but at the top of the game, I just these days I cannot imagine really caring who's Man United and who's Man City and who's Chelsea and who's Newcastle, because it's just one whole, it's you know, superpower A versus superpower B, and I feel very sorry for the fans of those clubs, because obviously it isn't the same for them. But you must feel strange if you're Newcastle would be the ultimate example. If you're a Newcastle fan who's been through, what, you know, years of underachievement, but, you know, suddenly they're bought out by Saudi Arabia and maybe they'll end up winning things. But won't you always feel a bit weird about that? That it's you know, this whole thing of, we got our club back, but I mean, isn't it? It's Saudi Arabia's club now. And I just can't think, I would just feel weird about that, I think. I'd rather Bristol City were average and, you know, kind of like we are now, than that we were bought out by someone and we suddenly were champions, but it came with this weird sense of, but are there people suffering halfway across the world because of the people who own our club? It's just, that's not right.
Yeah, that's true, actually. So that's the thing. It's all, oh, I don't know. It's all so fucked.
Yeah.
So fucked. And if you start to, this is when I have these conversations, I go, there's not really much I can do about that.
No, I don't think you and me are going to solve it.
No.
It just got worse and worse. It's the same as any problem, right? It just snowballs and snowballs and snowballs. And like, there are these little moments where you think, this doesn't feel right. But there's nothing anyone can do. It's like an inevitability of it's almost like an inevitability of capitalism. It's like to I mean, this is the thing with the moralizing of it. Fans want their teams to succeed. To succeed now in football, you need not just millions, but you need billions. Who has billions? Who's ethical? You struggle to name anyone, don't you? So you're immediately in a situation where it's like, therefore, you have to put that to the back of your mind and just accept it, or stop supporting your team. And that feels like a really unfair. That's why I really sympathise with you. I'm not saying Newcastle fans should stop supporting you. I'm okay to moralise about it because I'm not a Newcastle fan, but it's a completely unfair thing to expect of fans to suddenly say, well, because of my moral compass, this thing that I've loved for my entire life is going to be dead to me. That doesn't feel right. But
no, I know what you mean. But like you said, people are going, a lot of proper, like the fans of the game are going lower league.
Yeah.
There's a lot of support for, like I see Charlie Baker talking about, whoever he's supporting now, and you know, people are, is Math Brown will go on about Brentwood, and you know, so it's happening, you know, it's still there.
I think what's really hard is just like I say, it's the identity thing. Football is identity, and you grow up, and at the age of 2, 3, 4, you're told you're a Newcastle fan, and then that builds into your identity, and that's almost one of the first ways you introduce yourself. Not that you necessarily go up to people, shake hands and go, I'm a Newcastle fan, but you know, it's a big part of what you are as a person, is this is part of my identity. And there's nothing right. It's in a way, it's a really lovely thing. And that's where the problem comes. How can you suddenly perform this about turn 20 years down the line? Maybe your kids have now grown up as Newcastle, and you're just overnight, you're not going to just say, okay, I've changed now. That's just...
No.
I think I do, yeah. I just don't know where you go with it. And I think it's really sad. And I think, obviously, I love this idea that, you know, people are going to support non-league teams more. And I think it's great. And I love non-league football. It's much closer to the game that I loved. But I just think it's an unreasonable expectation to put on fans. And it's also unreasonable to tar them with the association with, you know, Saudi Arabia. The only thing I don't like is when people revel in it, you know, this wearing a Saudi Arabian costume. And aside from the just racist elements of that, it's not, if people actively lauding the Saudi Arabia regime is pretty atrocious. But for the vast majority of Newcastle fans, they're just sitting there thinking, well, maybe we'll finally win the league. And it's a bit unfair to suddenly say to you, well, you're not going to be able to enjoy that success because of a decision you had nothing to do with.
True.
That you don't have an option in that, you didn't even get a vote in it. So yeah, feels a bit harsh, doesn't it? But it's even more, it's like saying, well, you can enjoy that if you like, but think about the people being publicly executed for being gay in Riyadh. Yeah. It's like, well, that's not really on the Newcastle fans, is it? It's not, that wasn't their decision. No. So I really feel for everyone. It's an absolute no-win situation for everyone.
It's like everything, isn't it? Everything just goes back to money now. It's just every single thing. Like, we've got now around London, they've got the new sort of low emission zone that's been extended out, and they go, "Oh yeah, we want to lower the emissions and the pollution in London." They go, "No, it's not. You just want to make money. It's all about money. You don't give a shit. You don't care. There's still turtles with straws up their noses. You don't give a shit."
Oh, the hypocrisy, the climate hypocrisy is some of the best there is, isn't it? I mean, I think in a way, the greatest trick that's ever been pulled is convincing the likes of you and me to feel like we've destroyed the planet because...
Yeah.
I feel like, I put my baked bean can in with the cardboard last night. I fucked the planet, you know? No, what fucked the planet is... Like these, you know, Shell, they fuck the planet. Like, it's amazing that these are the people, Shell doing adverts about how we should be greener. And it's like, the level of hypocrisy is just off the charts.
Yeah. You're digging holes into the earth that we live on. It's creating a huge problem. Yet I haven't washed out my peanut butter jar, so
you're a monster. Yeah. that is it. Ah. That really does feel... I mean, the same with everything, isn't it? You know, we're the problem. The benefit scroungers are the problem. The self-employed trying to scab 200 quid back here and there, we're the problem. It's not, for instance, the offshores with billions who don't pay a single bit of tax, the Amazons. And it's all just a feat of misdirection to make us feel shit about ourselves and think, well, we did this, when actually yeah, it's got nothing to do with us at all. That's not to say we can't try and do our best, but it's just,
no,
I'm not going to save the planet. Sadly,
yeah,
I don't,
exactly.
I don't know if that's within the remit of this podcast, but I don't think I can do it.
But like you said, we will do our best.
Yeah,
Paul, this has been fantastic. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh,
really enjoyed talking to you. It's been great, man. I can't believe how much like Mark you sound.
Everyone says that.
I didn't want to say anything. I wasn't going to say anything. I'm like, I might say that.
No. I get a lot of it. I get so much of that. And I even get I've had people I've known for years occasionally message me and say, "Hi, Mark." And they go, "Oh, shit."
Oh, mate. Where can we find you? Where can we find you online you need to be found?
Well, Twitter is at Paul_C_Watson. And you can help me on my quest to get this number that I don't have any idea, which will make me happy.
Forget that happy number.
Exactly. So, yeah, mostly just that one. And I'll generally whine on about what I'm doing until sort of those 30 likes come in and I can sit back and bask in the warm glow.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
No, real pleasure. Thank you.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.